One more time, I want to give the drummer some of this funky soul we got, yeah. You don't have to do no soloing, brother, just keep what you got.
This is Sound Opinions, and this week we're revisiting one of our favorite episodes from back in 2018.
You know, the lead singer is the guy in the band that usually gets most of the attention, the spotlight at the front of the stage. But this week we're going to focus on someone who's usually a little further back on the stage, the drummer. Someone who doesn't always get the attention, but is often just as deserving.
Greg, as a drummer, I could not agree more. It is satisfying to hear you say that. To start this show, we thought we needed to know a little bit more about what a drummer does and how he or she fits in with a band. For that insight, we spoke with drummer and composer Joe Wong. He is the host of The Trap Set, a podcast that is just about drummers. Joe has interviewed dozens and dozens of drummers, from jazz fusion great Billy Cobham to Brendan Canty of Fugazi to Bill Ward of Black Sabbath. He even interviewed me.
Wow.
For this conversation on our show with him, we started by asking why the drummer doesn't always get the same level of respect as others in the band.
I think it's because drummers are inherently nurturing people, and because of that, they are taken advantage of.
Right. We give and we give and we give.
What is this, a therapy class here? I thought we were talking about drummers.
Yeah, I think, drums are the most difficult instrument logistically and lifestyle-wise. I mean, you have to, from the very beginning, have a place to set up and play. And then when you want to start playing shows, you need to get a vehicle.
Yeah.
So we're still operating in the paradigm from when sheet music was the medium of choice. And even though drum beats are oftentimes essential to a song and inseparable from the song itself, drummers often get paid the very least.
All right, Joe, let's start with the basics. What would you say the role of drums are in rock and popular music? On a non-technical level, for the non-musicians.
I think that the drums, more than any other instrument, are what inject the sexual energy into rock and roll music.
Mm.
The beat is what makes you want to dance, and it's what made parents reject rock and roll in the very beginning.
Put the janks on me. I got the heebie jeebies and can't get well. I got the heebie jeebies and the Jew got the tail lip. Hey, by my baby, and no, no, well, I'm gonna ring your door till I break your bell. You gotta jump back, heebie jeebie, gonna get back, heebie jeebie, gonna duck back, heebie jeebie, gonna get back.
And I think it also, the drums are what enables lyrics to sound profound. If you take lots of rock lyrics in a vacuum and just try to read them as poetry without a drum beat, it's not going to work. The
right.
Drums are kind of what makes the singer sound important.
That's an interesting perspective. Most of the singers that I've dealt with tolerate drummers, but they don't necessarily say they're making me sound more profound. The perception is that drummers aren't really listening to the words. They're not listening to the song. They're about keeping that beat. They're driven by, rhythm, the loudness, the quietness, the nuance. Those aren't necessarily huge concerns when they're behind the kit. Do you find that there's sort of a inherent bias within rock band against a drummer?
Well, I think what you were just describing is perhaps a bad drummer or an inexperienced drummer. But any good drummer, of course, is listening to everything just as much as any other instrument. And just as any great guitar player usually has a great sense of rhythm, a drummer has a good sense of melody and is there to support that. I think that drummers could be considered the leader of a band in so much as they are fulfilling the role that perhaps a conductor does with a classical orchestra. They're setting up the transitions from one section of a song to the next. They're determining the dynamic levels as far as dropping down to a quiet section or back up to a climax. And of course, they're counting off the songs and determining the tempo.
You know, the joke in the Spinal Tap movie was obviously that the drummer is constantly, you know, disappearing. He's getting blown up, and, you know, it's just a rotating seat back there.
He exploded on stage. Just like that.
But obviously a great drummer can define a rock band. And I guess, what are the essential qualities of a great drummer?
That they're a great listener and oftentimes a great arranger. Oftentimes lots of the arrangements are kind of determined by the drummer. And sometimes the drum part is inseparable from the song. Picture Come Together without that iconic drum beat. Or Billie Jean without that iconic drum lead-in. There isn't just one role that the drums can play. They're not simply there to support the song. I think that, you know, transitioning from being an adequate drummer to a great drummer means that not only are you supporting the song, but you're inseparable from the song.
Joe, let's talk about some of the folks you've talked to. More than 100 drummers at this point. After talking to all of these drummers, all across the musical spectrum, have you noticed a couple of things that they have in common, personality-wise?
Well, as Greg mentioned earlier, there's this perception that drummers are expendable. And in fact, lots of drummers are kicked out of the bands that they helped make great.
Yeah.
And I think that makes them reckon with themselves in a way that other instrumentalists perhaps don't have to. And I think as a result, they have a level of self-awareness and introspection and wisdom that is perhaps lacking in other instrumentalists.
Mm-hmm. So they're good interview subjects.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so for example, I just spoke to Ralph Johnson from Earth, Wind, and Fire. There were a few drummers in Earth, Wind, and Fire, but Ralph was
Maurice White was a drummer initially for the Chess.
Yeah, he was a
studio
for Chess. Yeah, but his role in Earth, Wind, and Fire was primarily that of the songwriter and leader. And at one point, Maurice decided that the band was just going to stop touring, and Ralph, wasn't getting the giant royalty checks at that point. And you know, he went off and sold stereos. And I feel like when you have to kind of examine your identity apart from being that guy that plays drums from Earth, Wind, and Fire and really think about who you are as a person after achieving that kind of massive success, it leads to a more interesting, balanced view of yourself. I know the truth, now so do you. How.
Oh, that's interesting. We're also starting to see, aren't we, Joe, the physical rigors of drumming. I mean, Neil Peart has been saying that, you know, he can't play up to the standards he did with Rush for all those decades, just physically anymore. You know, it takes a toll.
Yeah, I think it definitely depends on the style of drumming. But yeah, Neil Peart retired, and Phil Collins can't play drums anymore because he messed up his back from years of drumming. On the other hand, I mean, Roy Haynes sounds just as great as ever, and I saw Elvin Jones a few times in the last couple years of his life, and he probably sounded better than he did.
Mm-hmm. No, and Charlie Watts is, over 70 years old, and he can still rock stadiums with a flick of that left hand.
I see a red door and I want it painted black. No colors anymore, I want them to turn black. I see the girls walk by dressed in their summer clothes.
Yeah, I think it depends on how kind of ergonomic your style is, and some drummers develop a style that just happens to sound good, but it's more athletic, and other drummers develop a style that's almost zen-like, and they can create this massive sound without expending too much energy.
In your view, in a rock band, you know, the essence of the drummer is you know, a rhythm keeper, the basic role. You're keeping the time, you're in some ways guiding the arrangement by the rhythm that you keep. What about the notion of the drums as a lead instrument in rock? Where do you stand on that?
Well, as I kind of alluded to before, I think that the drummer can be a leader in the sense that they're kind of steering the ship from the drum chair. But as far as the instrument being the main focus, I think that's more rare. It can happen. One example that springs to mind is John Stainer of Battles, who sets up right in the front of the stage. I feel like, if you listen to a song like Atlas, the drums are very much kind of the focus of that song. I would say that in some cases, Yaki from Can is the leader of that band or the main focus. As much as I love Damo's vocals, I don't think I'm listening for the vocals. I think they're just another texture, and the drums kind of take the center stage for me.
Yeah, Yaki Leipizzite is clearly integral to the Can sound.
Yeah, and sometimes it's just kind of like the lead instrument. Like that's what I'm listening to more than anything else.
So it's okay for rock drummers to be the lead instrument, is what you're saying, in your mind.
Yeah, but I also wouldn't marginalize the drummers that are just great supporting players, because it's probably just as difficult to be the straight man in a comedy duo as it is to be the guy yucking it up. And it's that's why they give out Oscars for best supporting actor as well as best lead actor.
Well, Abbott is the key to Costello, you know.
That's right.
I mean, Bud Abbott. All right, see, this is the Greg is leaving out the context here, Joe. We have been fighting.
Yeah, because Greg, what's your opinion?
Well, let me just say.
I love lead drums.
Let me say one name here. This is a fight that we've been having for 20 years. Keith Moon. This is the fight. I'm anti.
And I'm
what
very
do you mean
pro.
You mean you're anti, you don't like Keith Moon?
I do
you
not like Keith Moon. I think that he attempts to command the spotlight all the time, constantly, throughout The Who, and I find it an immense distraction.
All the people, they step back when a young man walked by.
And I've said drums should not be a lead instrument, with notable exceptions. Yaki Leipizzite, I think Battles, is a good one. Sometimes the Feelies do that, but very rare. And when it's done, it has to be done right and tastefully. And
tasteful.
Yeah, tasteful.
Rock has to be tasteful.
I believe the drums have to be tasteful, and Keith Moon is not tasteful. He's just a wanker.
What about Keith Moon? Tell us about Keith Moon, Joe.
I love Keith Moon. I love Keith Moon. I think I understand what you're saying, Jim, but I think for some reason it works for me. I think the fact that it's distasteful adds an element of chaos into that band. I mean, he's blowing stuff up and figuratively and literally, and it just kind of works.
Performance to me, and I Can See for Miles by The Who, those songs were being arranged around Keith's drumming.
I never see you when deliberately you put pain in my way. Well, here's a poke at you. You're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles.
And as you said, Joe, about the drummer playing an integral role as an arranger, I think Pete Townsend arranged a lot of those songs so that Keith's voice as a drummer would be out front, and it was intentional. It wasn't like Keith was usurping the song. In many ways, the song was written around his style of drumming.
Well, I guess my problem with The Who, is more than Moon. Moon is the biggest problem. Entwistle plays too much. Daltrey is a horrible cheese dog. And Moon
It sounds
is,
like
is,
you just don't like The
you
Who.
Just, no, I don't. I don't like The Who. But let me tell you how I think of Moon's drumming, right? I think of Moon's drumming like a bad metal guitar soloist who is doing hammer-ons. The whole time, you know what I mean? And like hammer-ons never worked in any song ever. Should not be done. And neither should Moon's nonstop drum fill with the cymbal crashes in the middle of the fills. That's me. That's just me.
Something about the way that Keith Moon is always kind of going outside of his comfort zone, and it feels like the songs are always on the verge of train wrecking, but they never quite train wreck, is what gives The Who their kind of essential energy.
All right. Well, I think that's an eloquent defense of Moon.
We're going to focus a little bit on drum fills, Joe. First of all, could you define a drum fill for us?
I think a drum beat is the sentence, and the drum fill is the punctuation.
Ooh.
So it can be a comma to lead us into the second clause of the sentence. It can be a period or an exclamation mark. And sometimes it can even be a question mark, the fill. But it's there to kind of bridge things together or put a period on things.
You know, some people have compared it to a guitar riff. It's similar to that. Would you agree?
I think a beat is similar to a riff in the sense that it's repetitive. Whereas a fill is something that usually only happens once.
So, Joe, give us a sense of what your favorite drum fills are. That will help us focus what exactly you're looking for in a drum fill, or how you define it.
See, for me, it's difficult to just pick a favorite drum fill absent the beat that it's coming from. It's kind of like using the punctuation analogy. It's like, well, what's your favorite exclamation mark? Well, it depends on the sentence. Tony Allen, who is most famous for playing with Fela Kuti, had a signature fill that feels like a sense of weightlessness. It's a syncopated tom fill that he executes in lots of his songs. It makes the song feel like it's floating in midair for a second, and then he drops back down into the groove and the weight comes back.
How about another?
One that lots of people cite is the break in Rocksteady by Aretha Franklin with Bernard Purdy on drums.
Yeah.
And that's another incredible, timeless drum break. It's been sampled a million times. And it kind of, that it kind of skirts the line between being a fill and a beat, because it basically, when everybody drops out, it's kind of an elevated version of the beat, and then he caps it off with this really cool signature Purdy hi-hat thing, and brings it back in. And basically the function that that has in the song is it just brings everything up, so that when the chorus comes back in, it just feels huge. It feels like a climax.
I'm, you know, as you know, I'm a huge John Bonham fan. Do we consider the beginning of Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin with the hi-hat thing, which, yeah, I'm 53. I've been trying to play that at least twice a week for my entire drumming life since age 13. I've never mastered it. I have no idea. You know, that 64th note or whatever the hell it is thing on the hi-hat. Is that hi-hat intro to Rock and Roll a fill or part of the beat?
I feel like it's an intro, you know, just like a guitar, just like
yet another like, category.
Well, I feel like it's I see what you're saying, where that's close to a riff in the same sense that like the Dazed and Confused riff is the intro to that song, right? That bass riff. I think of a fill as something that kind of bridges one part of the beat to the other, like filling in the space.
So the thunderous intro that Bonham plays when Stairway to Heaven kicks into high gear.
Yeah, exactly.
That Tom fill, that would be...
I think of that as a fill.
That's a classic fill.
We've been talking to Joe Wong, who heads up the Trap Set podcast in Los Angeles. Joe, thanks for coming on Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me, guys.
When we come back, Greg and I will share some of our favorite drum performances. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott here with Jim DeRogatis, and this week we're giving the drummer some.
Before the break, we talked about the role of drums in rock music. Now we're going to share some of our favorite drummers and drumming moments in pop music history. Licks, beats, fills, even solos, it's all up for grabs. Greg, what have you got to start us off?
Jim, I wanted to focus on a drummer who I don't think gets enough attention, Martin Atkins. He runs a label in Chicago called Invisible. He's a Brit that came to Chicago and has become a label owner, an author, a professor, a rabble-rouser. He's always been a punk, a great public speaker, a raconteur, and also a great drummer. He's worked with Ministry, Nine Inch Nails, his group Pigface, Killing Joke, but some of his best work came early in his career with Public Image Limited.
Yeah.
Their third album, The Flowers of Romance, Atkins played a big role and gave the drums a big role in that record because he was such a powerful percussionist. The track I'm going to focus on is called Under the House. It's basically drums and vocals by one Johnny Lydon, the head of Public Image Limited.
Formerly Johnny Rotten.
Yes. When Sex Pistols broke up, he formed Public Image Limited. It was an art punk band in the finest sense of the words, art and punk, very experimental, flipping the rock hierarchy around, foregrounding the so-called background instruments, in this case the drums, and making them the lead instruments on the track, with Lydon's vocals buried way back, competing for space in the mix with an opera that was playing on a TV set in the background. The tom drumming on this track is like a rampaging herd of elephants. There's some echo effects here that sort of were intended to replicate what the producer Nick Launay loved about Spanish gypsy music, aka flamenco, the hand clapping with the drum beats. Of course, much more powerful and robust than hand clapping. A marvelous example of lead drums on this track, Under the House from Public Image Limited and Martin Atkins on Sound Opinions. Under the House from Public Image Limited, Martin Atkins on those rampaging drums. What have you got for us first, Jim?
Well, Greg, you know, as a drummer myself, as a lover of percussive instruments, as a former contributor to Modern Drummer magazine, I'm going to try to illustrate a different aspect of what I value about great rock and pop drumming with each track. There's only one place for me to start. You know, I got a lot of tattoos. I got a lot of ink. I got only one drummer commemorated on my skin. Bass drum foot, John Bonham's Three Rings from Led Zeppelin IV. Bonham, simply put, is the best rock drummer ever. And it isn't about showiness. It isn't about complications, although some of his parts are really tricky and amazingly unique. It's about feel. I've interviewed John Paul Jones, the bassist in Led Zeppelin, a number of times, once at South by Southwest in front of about 1,000 ardent fans. I asked him about Bonzo, and he said, you know, that guy could sit down and play the old fiberboard carrying cases for his drums, and it would still sound exactly like Bonham. For the track I'm going to play, When the Levee Breaks, he actually set up at the bottom of a staircase, and there was nothing but two stereo microphones at the top of the stairs. Zeppelin was recording with the mobile unit that Rolling Stones owned at Headley Grange out in the countryside, and it was just monstrous. Page said, I had this riff, but it was Bonzo's drums that made it everything. How good is this drum part? You know, for one thing, it starts with a couple of bars of the song isolated. But it's more than that. There's a reason it's been sampled more. And I think this is a conservative number. 120 other hit recordings. People from Eminem to the Beastie Boys, from Beyonce and Jack White partnering up to Dr. Dre to Bjork, they have all drawn parts of this drum part. It is the feel. It is the power. It is the just pure solidity. These are cinder blocks banging against a wall. There's no subtlety here. I believe Bonham was playing the Ludwig Orange Vista Light set on this track. I had to go buy one when I mean, this is as good as rock drumming gets. John Bonham, Led Zeppelin, When the Levee Breaks on Sound Opinions.
If it keeps on raining, levee's gone.
Nino Levy taught me to weep and moan. Led Zeppelin reinterpreting, of course, the great Memphis Mini on Zeppelin IV in 71. Greg, your next drummer track.
Jim, I wanted to highlight Janet Weiss of Slater Kinney. She is one of the great drummers in rock. I mean, she obviously is coming out of a tradition of great female drummers. Mo Tucker of the Velvet Underground, Sheila E., Gina Shock of the Go-Go's, all the way up through, you know, War Paint's Stella Mazgua. There's so many great drummers, great female drummers in rock. Janet Weiss is a towering presence. Male, female, you name it, she is a great drummer. There's no accident that Slater Kinney became a great band when she joined in the 90s. She's been the linchpin of that band for decades. She's also played with people like Stephen Malkmus's Jix and the Slater Kinney spin-off Wild Flag, Bright Eyes, The Go-Between, Shins. But her best work, I think, has come with Slater Kinney. What Janet Weiss does is serve the song. She is a great drummer because she understands the arrangement. In many cases, she helped craft the arrangement for these songs and knows where to accent, where to lay back, where to drive, where to color in the textures around around the melody and the verses. The song Youth Decay from Slater Kinney's 1999 album all hands on the bad one. Just listen to what Weiss does at the end of each verse, the accents that she's putting on to punctuate those verses, the syncopations. The fills and accent marks on this song are just superb, and at the same time driving it headlong until it feels like it's running off the rails at the very end. It's 2 minutes of excitement from a great drummer. Janet Weiss from Slater Kinney's Youth Decay on Sound Opinions. That is Youth Decay from Slater Kinney with Janet Weiss on drums. Jim, what's your next pick?
Greg, When the Levee Breaks and Bonham, it's all about that beat and the feel. The next song I'm going to highlight, XTC's Senses Working Overtime, is about a great drum fill. Several of them, actually. What's a fill? We were talking about that with Joe. Can connect one part of a song to another. Can happen once. Can happen several times. Terry Chambers is not a name a lot of people would put among the greats, but I think he put XTC on the map. His drumming was incredibly innovative on the first six albums or so by XTC. He was working with engineer Hugh Padgham. It was all about the tom-toms, much like Martin Atkins on Flowers of Romance, avoiding cymbals, as the Feelies always said. Mm. The cymbals clash with the frequency of the guitars. So it's this tribal African beat, but then these wonderful musical fills that are essentially hooks as Andy Partridge builds up. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 senses working overtime. You know, the phrase, the melody, the hook is completed by Terry Chambers on his tom-toms. It's just a brilliant part. There's a good documentary recent, This Is Pop, on Showtime about XTC. Everybody in the band, you feel sorry for them because it was Andy Partridge's train set. He didn't want to share with anybody else. I think Terry Chambers is the most overlooked member. Here he is, Senses Working Overtime by XTC on Sound Opinions. One, two, three, four, five. Senses Working Overtime. XTC. Greg, your next drummer.
Yes, Jim. I'm proud to highlight once again the late, great Clyde Stubblefield. You know, when we talk about that phrase, give the drummer some, James Brown.
He is the funky drummer.
He was looking at Clyde Stubblefield. Said, yeah. Give the drummer some. He knew what he was talking about. Funky drummer. The highlight track in any Clyde Stubblefield reel is one of the most sampled drum beats in music history. You talk about When the Levee Breaks by John Bonham. This is right up there with that. Stubblefield was a master drummer. I love these guys who, as they say, lay back and burn. They never overplay, but they know exactly what to do to keep things danceable. You know, Roger Hawkins with the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, or Al Jackson, the great Stax drummer. Stubblefield played that role with Brown's band. When Brown sort of dispensed with chord changes and basically turned every instrument in his band into a percussion instrument, he centered everything around those drums. Clyde Stubblefield was the guy. Clyde Stubblefield's left hand is basically God. If you talk to any drummer, they will say, Clyde Stubblefield's left hand, that's incredible. Just listen to what he's doing with the left hand. What he was doing with that left hand on the song I Got the Feeling is incredible. He plays this, what they call a drop whip, kind of a three-beat kind of sequence against the eighth notes on the hi-hat. And this groove is just, you cannot escape it. It melds with the bass and the horns to create this incredible sense of syncopation. It's very simple, very subtle, but he is a master at it. And when he adds little accents to it on top of it, you just go crazy with how wonderful the beat is making you feel.
I believe you're genuinely excited. This is nice to hear you talk this way about drumming. You want me to show you how to play it sometime?
Let me tell you, I've watched drummers do it, and I'm impressed, but nobody can do what Stubblefield did, the way Stubblefield actually did it.
I agree.
Clyde Stubblefield on James Brown's I Got the Feeling on Sound Opinions.
All right! Baby, 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 baby. Baby, 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 I got the feeling, baby, baby, sometimes I'm up, sometimes I'm down, I'm around and down, a level with the ground, baby, I said level with the ground,
That is a great Clyde Stubblefield, I Got the Feeling by James Brown. Jim, what is your final great drum track?
I have to end by emphasizing, Greg, that I think the drums are primarily a support instrument. They are both the foundation of all rock and pop modern music, but they're not supposed to be showy. That's my problem with Keith Moon. There are very, very intricate drummers, Neil Peart of Rush, who are still musical. I value, though, concision, musicality, and feel above all. I love Ringo Starr. I love Marky and Tommy Ramone. Mm. They're perfect. They're simple, but they're always perfect. I guess if I got to choose one, though, I'm going with Charlie Watts. Listen to Honky Tonk Woman. You know, it starts with 8 bars of just percussion. I always thought Charlie was playing the cowbell and then coming in with the drums in the beat that sets up Keith Richards' guitar riff for the song, and then a really tasteful, very musical fill. It wasn't. It was Jimmy Miller plays cowbell, and Watts then comes in with drums, but they're integral. When I learned to play it, spending those endless months in my basement at age 13, I played both the cowbell and the drum part. Charlie's all about the feel. He's British, and he's a Brit who loves R&B and jazz. There's this uniquely British thing where they're always slightly behind the beat, as opposed to an American drummer is often on top of the beat or in front of the beat. Charlie's always behind. You know, he speeds up, he slows down. If we put a metronome to him, and, you know, modern drummer and magazines like this have done that, he's a mess, right? He's not consistent. But he's perfect. He's perfect, and it's about the feel. It's about the groove. It's about breathing, the way your body breathes. And you speed up as you get excited, and you slow down sometimes as you take a pause. That's Charlie. Just listen to and value what he's doing on Honky Tonk Woman by the Stones, 1969 on Sound Opinions. Honky Tonk Woman by the Rolling Stones. You know, Greg, I've interviewed all of the Stones, and of course, Jagger and Richards. I mean, they're royalty, right? Mm-hmm. You feel in the presence of the gods from Olympus. But I had tea once with Charlie for 3 hours. I think that's one of my proudest moments as a rock critic. As always, we want to hear from you. What are your favorite drum tracks and why? Call and leave us a message at 888-859-1800. Coming up next, we'll hear from one of the most influential and another of the most sampled drummers of all time, Bernard Purdy. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott here with my partner, Jim DeRogatis. This week, we are all about drums. And you know, in the 60s and 70s, Bernard Pretty Purdy was one of the most prolific session drummers out there, one of my absolute favorites. If you listen to a Steely Dan record, an Aretha Franklin record, James Brown, Al Cooper, Nina Simone, Hall & Oates, Miles Davis, hundreds more, Bernard Pretty Purdy was on there.
You know, his style, Greg, is known as the Purdy Shuffle. Not only has it influenced a generation or three of drummers, but it's frequently been sampled ever since the 80s.
You can hear Bernard Purdy's unique style shining on tracks like that 1970 soul classic Ooh Child by the Five Stair Steps. Sound Opinions producer Ayanna Contreras spoke with Purdy about his career and contributions to popular music, starting with that song.
Well, Ooh Child was also a demo. And at that particular time, Stan Benson, who wrote it, he also put down he was the producer. We didn't have anything for 2 hours. We just couldn't. He wanted it. He wanted the country. He wanted this. He wanted that. By the time 2 hours had come about, we had not had a real good part for the song. You know, knowing him and when working with him on other stuff, I said, Stan, just give me 10 minutes. Changed a few things, and he said, "Pretty, but 10 minutes. That's all I'm asking." He said, "Oh, okay." 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later, Ooh Child.
Ooh Child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh Child, things will get brighter.
And it's interesting because that song, listening to it, really, it is your drum licks that introduce the song and really just give it this forward momentum. It's
exactly.
Really amazing.
Because this is what they heard. The kids, the guys that wrote it, the family, they were all family members. They heard it and, oh, yeah, oh, Purdy, yeah. And we did it. We actually, 20 minutes later, we have Ooh Child. Ooh Child made Stan Benson a millionaire. A millionaire. The writing, the productions, and how many times did this thing get in movies, soundtracks, and all this other stuff? A couple of thousand. Not a couple of hundred, but it's been sampled so much. And been in so many movies. For me, there was a lot of things that I had to learn that I didn't know I was producing back in the 60s or the 70s. I do my job. It was a job for me. But I did learn the technical part, and I finally went out and I started producing some records myself. But if I'd have known with all those records that came through.
Purdy is referring to iconic records that he played on, like Just One Look by Doris Troy.
Just one look, and I felt so hard.
And Gil Scott-Heron's The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
I didn't know that I was actually producing records. I just hear things. But I also knew what I was doing. They all called me to do and to play. They wait for me to play and make these records. So I did learn that I had something to offer. I just didn't learn the business soon enough to get some of the gobble gobbles money.
And that's the thing. I mean, you have this, and you're saying all these people calling out to you, the wide variety of artists, a lot of jazz, a lot of, like, I would say almost primarily jazz, but every genre.
Every genre. With.
Absolutely, every genre. And it's a really signature sound. But one particular song I just have to ask you about, because it wasn't a hit. It's just a random, it's a random B-side that was by Melvin Bliss. And it was written and produced by Herbert Rooney of the Exciters, who had a big hit with Tell 'Em. But this is a throwaway song called Synthetic Substitution that starts with your drum break, which becomes the basically the basis of a whole entire genre of hip hop, the boom bap sound. Yes. So I could do boom boom bap, boom boom bap. I'm probably missing a note in there, but that's
you. All right.
The sun used to shine on my street, on my street. The moon was visible at all times.
Yeah, and the nicest part for me is that I'm still around to see this, and they are finally calling me for some of the stuff that I've done. They're finally asking me to, you know, do copyright.
And that's what's interesting. I saw that, yeah, that you've done drums that people can purchase and sample, and you get the... Yeah. Because, I mean, I think people don't understand, or maybe some people don't understand the way the samples work, where if you played on the record, you don't necessarily get the bread.
No.
No.
Only the artists.
Right.
Only the artists. It's the same thing with the, like, Rocksteady. They got to pay Aretha.
So it's like performance and songwriting, like whoever has the publishing.
Right.
And that's it. And that's everybody else. Especially, and then it's so funny because it's the drum break, right? Like it's the drum.
And that's what rappers, they all feel that they're writing songs by taking my beat from a song, this one, that one, and using it and never offering. So, yes, I was bitter for a while. No more. I stopped being bitter because bitter means that you don't live long because you're going to be upset and you're going to go out fighting with people to get money and get your credit. Y'all got it. I'll turn it over to lawyers now. I have learned that I just want to have fun. I want to enjoy myself and have a ball. I give lectures all over the world. And I'm just happy, happy to be able to say that I can still play.
That is the legendary drummer Bernard Pretty Purdy talking with our producer, Ayanna Contreras. I guess that I'm a
Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill and Alex Claiborne. And with this, our last episode recorded at WBEZ over the past 15 years, we bid farewell to Brendan Banaszak, who's staying at the station while we move forward as an independent production. Brendan put heart and soul into Sound Opinions for the last 4 years, and we'll miss him. But like everyone at WBEZ, we wish him the best and hope he'll keep listening. Thanks, everyone, and we'll be back at the same bat times on the same bat channels next week.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
Hi, this is Laurel Stone in Tullahoma, Tennessee. I just wanted to thank y'all for playing the episode about The Replacements. It brought back a lot of great memories of my college days in the early 90s. I loved listening to their music in my dorm room, and I got to see them in Nashville at 328 Performance Hall, and it was a wonderful show. We went back behind the venue at the end of the show and was able to talk to the band, and I got Paul Westerberg to sign my arm. Thank you so much. Keep up the good work.
Hey, great show about The Replacements. I'm calling from Las Vegas. I had seen them growing up in Chicago, and never knew what you were going to get. Saw their last Grant Park show. I'd seen them when they just started out playing Dresses, and they were just sloppy. And actually had a neighbor who sat next to them on a plane, didn't know who they were, and the entire band just opened up their table trays and just kind of passed out after talking to my neighbor. And my neighbor was like, they were really nice, but they all passed out.
Hi, my name is Lou Ellsworth Yao. I saw The Replacements back in 1986 in San Francisco at the I-Beam, and I did see one of those sloppy, reckless, out-of-hand shows, and regardless, still thought it was fantastic. I think that they are a band that is reflective of the American experience, a place that has such fantastic potential, but never really is met, as indicative of the song Unsatisfied. I think we can all sort of relate to The Replacements and the American experience, especially in light of this current election season. Thank you very much for a great show. Bye-bye.
Hey, Jim and Greg, it's Chuck from Arlington Heights. You posed the question, did The Replacements change my life? Yeah. I was a bit of a late bloomer to The Replacements. I finally caught on in about 1988. In the summer of 1989, they opened for Tom Petty during his Full Moon Fever tour and played Poplar Creek in Hoffman Estates. I got second row tickets. I got there early. I got all revved up for the show. And The Replacements hit the stage. Paul kind of came out into the empty seats during the opening song, Nightclub Jitters, just started crawling over the seats. It was like Buddy Guy going into the crowd with his 100-foot guitar chord, except there was no crowd. There were like five guys yelling, Tim, at the top of their lungs. And in the back lawn, there was probably a ton of people yelling, We want Tom. And it wasn't for Tommy Stinson, it was for Tom Petty. Everybody says that was an average show, but for me it was life-changing. It was like watching rock and roll and professional wrestling all mixed into one bag. Thanks. Bye.
No more messages.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.